chapter 20, a chapter entitled The Dynasty of Puru, text 21. Please repeat after me. Mata Bastra Pitu Putro,
Mata Bastra Pitu Putro,
Yena Jata Sa Evasa,
Yena Jata Sa Evasa,
Varasva Putram Dushmanta,
Varasva Putram Dushmanta,
Mava Manstha Shakuntalam,
Mava Manstha Shakuntalam,
Mata Bastra Pitu Putro,
Mata Bastra Pitu Putro,
Yena Jata Sa Evasa,
Yena Jata Sa Evasa,
Varasva Putram Dushmanta,
Varasva Putram Dushmanta,
Mava Mamsta Shakuntalam,
Mava Mamsta Shakuntalam,
Mata Bastra Pitu Putro,
Mata Bastra Pitu Putro,
Yena Jata Sa Evasa,
Yena Jata Sa Evasa,
Varasva Putram Dushmanta,
Varasva
Mava Mamsta Shakuntalam,
Mava Mamsta Shakuntalam,
Mata Bastra Pitu Putro,
Mata Bastra Pitu Putro,
Yena
Jata Sa Evasa,
Varasva
Putram Dushmanta, Mava Mamsta Shakuntalam,
Mata Bastra Pitu Putro,
Mata, the mother, Vastra, just like the skin of a bellows containing air. Pitu, of the father, Putra, the son, Yena, by whom, Jata, one is born, Sa, the father, Eva, indeed,
Sir,
the son,
Bharasva,
just maintain, Putram,
your son,
Dushmanta,
O Maharaj Dushmant,
Ma,
do not,
Avamamsta,
insult,
Shakuntalam,
Shakuntala.
Translation and purport by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Translation: the voice said, O Maharaj Dushmant, a son actually belongs to his father, whereas the mother is only a container, like the skin of a bellows. According to Vedic injunctions, the father is born as the son. Therefore, maintain your own son and do not insult Shakuntala. Purport. According to the Vedic injunction, Atma Vai Putra Namasi, the father becomes the son. The mother is simply like a storekeeper because the seed of the child is placed in her womb. But it is the father who is responsible for maintaining the son. In Bhagavad Gita, the Lord says that he is the seed-giving father of all living entities, Aham Bija Prada Pita, and therefore he is responsible for maintaining them. This is also confirmed in the Vedas. Eko Bahunam Ya Vidadhati Kaman. Although God is one, he maintains all living entities with their necessities for life. The living entities in different forms are sons of the Lord, and therefore the Father, the Supreme Lord, supplies them food according to their different bodies. The small ant is supplied a grain of sugar, and the elephant is supplied tons of food, but everyone is able to eat. Therefore, there is no question of overpopulation. Because the Father, Krishna, is fully opulent, there is no scarcity of food, and because there is no scarcity, the propaganda of overpopulation is only a myth. Actually, one suffers for want of food when material nature, under the order of the Father, refuses to supply him food. It is a living entity's position that determines whether food will be supplied or not. When a diseased person is forbidden to eat, this does not mean that there is scarcity of food. Rather, the diseased person requires the treatment of not being supplied with food. In Bhagavad Gita 7.10, the Lord also says, Bijam mam sarva bhutanam. I am the seed of all living entities. A particular type of seed is sown within the earth, and then a particular type of tree or plant comes out. The mother resembles the earth, and when a particular type of seed is sown by the father, a particular type of body takes birth. Om Ajnana Timirandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshuron Militam Yena Asmai Shri Guruve Namaha Shri Chaitanya Omeno Vishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Svapadantikam Deham Shri Gurum Shri Yuta Padakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavamsa Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunathanvitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Pada Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakhanvitamsha E Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dina Bandhu Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Aptakanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Vrishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vanchakalpa Tarubhyascha Kripa Sindhu Bhavacham Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadada Shivasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. The translation is, the voice said, O Maharaj Dushmant, a son actually belongs to his father, whereas the mother is only a container like the skin of a bellows. According to Vedic injunctions, the father is born as the son. Therefore, maintain your own son and do not insult Shakuntala. The point that is being stressed here in this verse by Krishna is making the point, really, that he is the seed-giving father. He is the maintainer of all. And therefore, he is the proprietor. Actually, when in scriptures, when a particular point is being stressed, it is often that we need to take a complete picture. At that, we cannot take a sentence just out of context. Radhanath Swami, His Holiness Radhanath Swami has said that when I read the Bhagavatam, I do not take just one sentence, I take the complete picture, because there is the need to stress a particular point. So for example, if we say that this devotee is the most beloved, it doesn't mean that the others are not beloved. But the point is made that this devotee is the most beloved. So same way here, this is not meant to be any demeaning statement that the mother has no... So in a mundane, in a material relationship of mother, father, children, of course we know the parents have critical responsibility for the child. And in fact the mother does play a key role. But the point stressed here is that Krishna is the seed-giving father, and as the father, he is the sole proprietor of everything. And here in the mother, which is Mother Nature, is supplying everything under the command of the father. Actually, Prabhupada goes on to say in the purport, he makes some very interesting statements. He says that this overpopulation theory is a myth. And if you read in today's, if you see the environment today, or we kind of hear the news everywhere, everybody seems to think that the main problem is that too many people and we have shortage of food. But actually, there are many, many books, many objective analysis done, which clearly indicates that actually vegetarian diet is not only, of course, morally right, that that may be a personal view, but what is factual and what cannot be disputed by anybody, it has never been disputed, is that it is also a meat-led diet is a very agricultural inefficient diet, which means that the resources that are given by the Lord by way of land, rains, actually we have never seen anybody create land. Never heard about it. We've never seen anybody create even a drop of water. They have to ultimately, you know, manage and maneuver and manipulate with what we have. But half the grains of the world are actually, half the grains in the US are actually fed for animals which are being slaughtered for meat. And the ratio is 1 to 16, wherein it needs 16 pounds of grain to feed 1 pound of beef, of meat. Why? Because the animals actually consume, they are fattened and they consume so much of land, which is you know, for soya beans or for corn, whatever, in the US particularly, and in Europe, where actually, which if it was left for a vegetarian diet, would be giving 16 times more product. So, who can say that actually there is not enough food? Also, there are surpluses in one country, there are shortages in another country, but because there is a feeling of proprietorship and a sense of belonging, and we are constantly pressed to think that this is mine and this is not mine, we are also taught that we are never taught a kind of world view. See, ultimately, there is a selfish view which is prevalent very strongly and increasingly so, that everything is for me, how can I benefit, what is in it for me. Even nowadays, it is even to the detriment of our family members, that I come first, then others. But even if we were to take a larger view that, okay, it's not just me, also my family, we may feel we are unselfish. But then we are looking at it at the expense of somebody else, that is, with some other families. Then one may take a larger view that, okay, if it is not just a family, a whole community. But there also we are talking of one community, my community, not another community. And then if you were to take a larger view and say that it is a country view, that, you know, I'm a nationalist, I belong to this country. But there again we are talking of my country, and that means this is mine and this is not yours. And we have so many complex obstacles for people to come into the country, get out of the country. It is very intimidating, actually, to go through the customs and passport, because they are meant to make you feel intimidated. So this is whole idea is that they want to see that they filter in only those whom they want them to come, who can add value, material value to them, to eyes, whether it is as a tourist or as a the work permit. Others are all junk. They can't be allowed. And they're hounded out and pushed out. So this sense is there. Nobody ever teaches us to take a world view, to say that we are part of somebody else who's the owner, and therefore we are a child of God. If we take that view and if we live that life, the whole picture changes, because then we are looking at everyone as brothers and sisters. And there may be a world order. We understood about the varnas and the ashrams. Therefore, according to the skills, according to our backgrounds, according to our capabilities, we have divisions. But these divisions are not leading to inequalities. Everybody is equal in the eyes of God as we are spirit soul. But everyone prospers because we do what we do best, rather than doing somebody else's things second best or not well. So that is the perfect order which used to prevail earlier, and everyone coexists happily, not thinking that somebody is superior. Someone has to be the prime minister. But it doesn't mean that the prime minister feels he is superior to somebody who has to just be a carpenter, because each one has his own capabilities. It was the values, and the Brahmin order was not according to birth. The Brahmin order was according to the qualities. Someone was Brahminical who actually not only developed those qualities personally, but also lived those qualities. Therefore, he was fit to lead and advise the Kshatriya class and the Vaishya class as to how they should perform also. And the others used to be happy to take advice. So this was the coexistence that remained. So now today we see a complete diversion, that there is a inbuilt, the whole society makes it enormously selfish. You also see, when you talk of overpopulation, you also see land grabs, you know, people acquiring tens of thousands of acres, in which, you know, they, in fact, in the larger countries, we are not used to it in India, but in the US particularly, this unheard of if people have 10 acres and 20 acres. Usually it is in hundreds, if not in thousands. And there are people who even have hundreds of thousands of acres, as they call ranches. So then they feel that, okay, according to our financial strength and our material status, we have the proprietorship over such a large area. But because they have then divided the world order in such a way wherein they can collectively, as we say, honor among thieves. So they collectively feel that, okay, as part of a country, or as part of a system of economic governance, we set rules in such a way that it benefits us, and therefore, for times to come, for decades and decades, even for centuries, other countries have great difficulty to enter into that club, unless they play by those rules. So therefore, we can see that it is not a question of shortage of land or the shortage of food, it's a question of consciousness. So whether we can do anything about it individually, of course, one may say it is very difficult, certainly. But at least the mental understanding should be clear that this is a nonsense theory, that it is entirely based on selfishness and greed. And this is also seen in so many factors. I mean, we look at how many tens of millions of children are murdered every year, aborted. Because ultimately it comes down to, in most cases, know that for the boy and the girl who have taken the responsibility, I mean, they've not taken the responsibility, but who have actually been kind of created the seed, it's an obstacle to their sense gratification, for the enjoyment. It's a hindrance, so they want to just remove it, as they say, remove the tissue. In China, for instance, about 40 years ago, they adopted it as a policy, because the government is based on authoritarian system where they can ram through the policies they think are good. So the objective was economic development at all costs. There was no question of cultural values or social values or other things, no question of feelings. So the policy was to have only one child per family. And it was not just a policy meant for appealing to others. It was policy which was enforced, insisted upon, and it was by law. You'd be put in jail, there would be so many discriminations, it is impossible. So over 20-30 years they pushed it, So they have achieved an objective wherein within maybe 10 or 15 years, India will overtake China in population. So they're now stabilizing at probably 1.2 or 1.3 billion, and then over time it will go down. But now they're seeing the ramifications and the problems that are coming up because of, number one, it has become such a selfish society that each one looks for himself. Also, this has led to so many abortions because they would like a male child because there's only one child. So then if they find out from the tests that it is not, then they were to remove it. If they have one and they have another, they're likely to have another one, they will remove it. So all kinds of things. So this has gone to an extreme where even the country has actually, the largest country in the world, actually played a role in that. So we can see that the norms that apply today are based on what is best for me, or at best, me and my extended family, whoever are within my own reach, and others be damned. Doesn't matter what happens, I must take care of them, and I'm proud of that. Even in the case of animals, we talked of, I forget now, but it is something in the billions every year. Billions of animals cumulatively are being killed for meat product. But the hypocrisy is that so many of them very strongly and indignantly talk about animal rights. Now, we believe in animal rights, we believe in everyone's rights. But it is only those, like if, for instance, to preserve a koala bear or a polar bear in the Arctic region, because from 500 numbers have come down to 200, it's a huge campaign, or for tigers or something. I know some people who are actually, one person who's the chairman of the World Wildlife Fund, which is the kind of important body here, and he has a extensively non-vegetarian diet. Now he's no more, but he used to have extensively. That means he used to say that. So it is a hypocritical thing that you feel you have made a law that certain animals are like cats and dogs because they're domesticated and they're kept at home. So of course, now of course in some countries they even eat dog meat. But let's say most people may not touch that. But they'll say that some are meant to be eaten, others how will we survive? Where does it say? I mean, over centuries, over yugas, people have survived, prospered, there's no problem. And as is mentioned in the purport, Krishna's arranged in such a way that there is no shortage. I mean, you don't see an elephant starving. Has anyone seen an ant or an elephant starving? We don't see them actually starve. But we do see people starving. And that is primarily because of a man-made creation of problems wherein certain continents or certain countries which are poor, and unless they completely, totally, abjectly surrender according to allow themselves to be completely exploited, it may not be so obvious. But if effectively it comes that they have to completely kind of be run as puppet states practically, they're pawns, otherwise they would be in great difficulty. And therefore, what are the results of this? The result is, you have pollution because of this greed, each one to himself. So, there is no responsibility, accountability to God. There is pollution, there is nuclear disasters. We had one almost 30 years ago in Russia, and now we had recently in Japan. The consequences may not be known immediately, but over time, so many aspects. I mean, the Bhopal disaster, where tens of thousands of people were dead, or so many children for future were maimed. The oil spills that take place. So these are the larger ones, but the smaller ones would go unnoticed. So these are just symptoms of the problems, and there are we can see in our day-to-day life also. We sometimes don't we don't recognize. But how there are signs of a kind of craziness all around us, because based on very intensive greed and selfish desires. Just a couple of days ago, a devotee sent a mail, which I thought some of the points which kind of just some of the points actually fit into what I was saying just now. The point was made that it was just to show that some of the ridiculous situation around us, and as a result of the selfishness and the greed, that today rice may be sold at, say, 40 rupees a kg, but a SIM card is free. And he says that a pizza comes faster to a house than an ambulance or the police. Then he said, for footwear, that is what you wear, they're put in AC, air-conditioned showrooms, but the food that we eat is sold on the footpath. Then lemon juice, to have lemon juice where they have artificial flavors, but for dishwash liquids, they put real lime. And so there's so many like this. He goes on to list, and in a poor country like India, we say that there are so many millions of poor people, and yet two cricket teams were sold for 3,300 crores. You know, so it's extreme. So we can see that it isn't really, I mean, these are man-made. Krishna didn't have a design when he put us into this world that we will create such a ridiculous situation. He must really be sad and probably laughing at the same time. I don't know, I think. But so then also buildings, I mean, you can see infrastructure, you can, on one hand, when it is private initiative or individually, because there's our own money involved, the building comes up in 9 months, sometimes even less. And then you also see bridges or, you know, ports which take something like 15 years, 20 years. So it's nobody's accountability in one way. So we can see these extreme situations where when it comes to individual need, and it is really extremely selfish. I also wanted to talk today briefly about a very great personality whose disappearance day we are celebrating today, and that is His Grace Jayananda Prabhu. Why are we talking about him? Is because you may wonder as to why would we talk about the disappearance day of, and who is Jayananda Prabhu? Jayananda Prabhu was actually a disciple of Srila Prabhupada, but such a great Vaishnav that Srila Prabhupada actually ordered at his departure, he departed before Prabhupada. He's the only devotee that Prabhupada spoke about like this, when he said that for all times to come, he gave an order that his disappearance day should be celebrated on a par, he said, just like you celebrate other acharyas' disappearance days. So that is why, and because he was only 35 years ago in this world, so many of us were also present that time. So he was in many ways like a contemporary, and yet he was an ideal. And Srila Prabhupada gave this order because he saw that this was an ideal example for all of us. Absolutely the ideal. You can say the gold standard for any devotee anywhere in the world, anytime. What a disciple should be doing and living. So this was something which is for us. And of course, because he was completely, totally, 100% surrendered to Srila Prabhupada. What was his background? He was an American boy who was born in the US. He graduated from, he was in an upper middle class family. He graduated from the Ohio State University. He got a degree in mechanical engineering. But because he was so simple, and of course he was an extraordinary personality, therefore from childhood he didn't have any material needs such. So though he did his mechanical engineering degree, he could have got a job anywhere. But he didn't choose to take, he wanted to lead a very simple life, not get into the competitive material gain kind of situation. He didn't need that. He never got married. And he was, therefore he took voluntarily on his own, he took a job as a taxi driver. He took up a role as a taxi driver in San Francisco. So he left his state and went to San Francisco, and he was, so that he could be just having simple needs. And as Krishna arranged the whole situation, that Prabhupada had gone to the US in 66, he had started the New York temple, the where he started from the ghetto of Manhattan, which is the Bowery. He stayed there first, then he went to Lower East Side, where the 26 Second Avenue store is there. And from there, the very next temple, the second temple, and it's historic that the very second temple was on the other side of the U.S., which is on the West Coast in San Francisco. So Prabhupada went to San Francisco at the invitation of Mukunda Maharaj, who was Michael at that time, who called him there and who had just gone there a short while ago to do some preparations. And when Prabhupada went there, he started this very, very tiny storefront temple, very small, probably even smaller than even the Matchless Gift store. This is on Frederick Street. And when he started and incidentally, San Francisco is, these are in the words of one of the sannyasis, one of Prabhupada's disciples, who said that San Francisco at that time and today is the most degraded city in the world. It's the capital of hippies. It was the capital of hippies. It means that people could do anything. There was no restrictions on sense gratification. You could do any kind of thing, you know, drugs and whatever. It was completely free. So even by U.S. standards, it was really an extreme. So Prabhupada was only talking to all his guests who were coming to hear him were hippies. And he used to give a morning Bhagavatam, and then he would, in the evening, would be giving the evening lecture. So most of the hippies who would come, they would come only in the evenings, because obviously morning, so they wouldn't get up so early, you know, and they were stoned completely. So Jayanand was the only one who was not a hippie. The only devotee that time. Well, he wasn't a devotee that time officially. So he was the only person who was coming there. So practically in the morning, Bhagavatams, other than the few full-time devotees who were there, he was the only one who was coming regularly. And when, in his words later on, he said that Prabhupada was so much affectionate to all devotees. In New York as well as San Francisco, he would just give them, he wouldn't be telling them, do this, do that. He would just feed them, give them prasad, and you know, such love and such personal attention and affection that really had a major impact on Jayanand Prabhu. He was thinking, I'm just a taxi driver. He has nothing to gain from me. I'm just coming into the temple like this. And why is he, there's no other angle to it. So, and there was such warmth, you know, he would push him. So, and because he was alert and he was actually having a strong desire to learn something, spirituality, he was coming there. So, it dawned on him and he was absorbing all this. So, this was a major lesson that he could see that Prabhupada had a deep desire to preach and to serve the devotees. And he was serving prasad and the way he used to serve. So he would observe that, and he had imbibed it so much in his life, in his attitude. So as this went on, then over time, Jayanand was giving everything that he earned into as a taxi driver to the temple. Everything means everything. Never kept a single cent back. I mean, this is amazing to know. You know, we have heard about 50% you can keep, 50% nothing. He never went by that. He just gave everything. Whatever he earned, it was to the temple. Very silently, quietly. Prabhupada knew that because he was the only one who financed the temple at that time. He also gave, knowing Prabhupada's desire to preach and to publish the Bhagavad Gita, there was no funds that time. So he gave a princely sum of $5,000, which was all that he had, to Prabhupada. And Prabhupada never ever forgot it. Never. That this person has hardly come a few weeks ago and has given all that he had, $5,000, everything, just to print the Bhagavad Gita. So Prabhupada had a very deep affection and love for him. And then in a short while later, Jayanand joined the temple. Though he was a full-time devotee, but he was also working as a taxi driver. Why? Because he saw that the finances, of course, were needed. So for many years, he continued driving a taxi just so that devotees would, more and more devotees can come because the temple could be financed. But also, he was such a selfless person, so humble, he saw everybody as superior to him. So he always, what he did was, and he was a fantastic preacher. So a very short time later, actually he was the senior most person, because devotees would come, people would join the temple, leave, and then some of the devotees were sent to other centers. So he was there constantly. So he was the senior most temple, but he would actually bring people into the temple off the streets, literally. And his nature was so loving and so friendly that people would warm up to him, they would come to him. And then he would train them, and those who were sincere and were working for some time, he would, you know, make them pujaris or, you know, for deity worship or cooking or various services, Harinam Sankirtan. And he himself would, do the garbage collection or the toilet cleaning or the, you know, sweeping the floors, any job that was needed. If it was needed, he would do the temple president's job. As soon as he found someone who had some qualification, he would put him there and then go back to what he was doing. So his nature and mood was entirely to serve. And also, he wanted others to be more and more in touch with Prabhupada. This is amazing. You know, it's not fiction, it's reality. I mean, we may think that we read in the ideal world, in the Satya Yoga, in the Treta Yoga, I mean, how when Krishna was there, the perfect examples. But this is one where here was a devotee in the Kali Yuga, in the US, in that cultural revolution period, where his only desire was that he would let he would do those services so that the new devotees got a chance to be with Prabhupada. I mean, it was so natural for anyone to just run to be when Prabhupada was there. Because you can imagine, those who joined the temple that time, there were very few devotees who would come. Not like today. And that too, Prabhupada's personality also, his example, just seeing him and being with him was so inspiring. And then when he would go, they would feel their world is crashing down, because they were so scared outside, they didn't know, you know, and he had just started. So in such a situation, their vulnerability was so high that they had to cling to Prabhupada. And here was a devotee who was forsaken that chance. It would have been natural for him to be always with Prabhupada. But he would always be working outside or helping, so that other devotees would get a chance to be with Prabhupada. And also do those services which nobody else would do or could not do. So that was the way he went about. And also he was an excellent preacher. So if necessary, he would give class. He would also lead the kirtan. But if somebody else was there, he would immediately make him lead the kirtan. So in fact, he was a perfect leader, but he never took any position. Of course, his sadhana was impeccable. With all these services, he used to work 18-hour days in services, but yet he was the first person in the morning. He was always there at Mangalarti. He was always there for kirtan, very often also for Harinam kirtans if he could. So his routine was incredible and his sadhana was impeccable. Also, it is said that during the time he was there, he made the most number of devotees in ISKCON. This is a feeling of many devotees that there was no number count, but it was just he had that personality and just that purity which came out, that everyone just flocked to him. And there are so many, many stories of how there's one devotee called Jambuvan. And he recalled that when he came to the temple, just like a hippie, the kindness and the warmth which he received from Jayanand, you know, and he got him, fed him prasad, sat with him, talked to him, you know, then they would come back again just to be with him. So, and he was a very compassionate preacher, very, very, he wasn't very harsh in that way. Another thing was, he never wanted any prestige. So to the extent that it was a known fact among all the devotees that if they wanted any association of Jayanand, they cannot speak anything good about him in his presence. The minute they would start, he would just walk away. He couldn't hear that. Also, he would never criticize anyone. It is said that there was not a single devotee ever heard Jayanand Prabhu speak anything bad about anyone. If he had to correct someone in a service, he would do it. But also, the way he would say is, you know, it is understandable, we all make mistakes, and that's how he would put it. But he could never criticize. And if he was present when somebody else was being critical of another devotee, he would very quietly, silently just withdraw. Of course, Sunday feast was the love feast, as Prabhupada had started, was a key factor for all devotees, for everyone to come there. And especially, you know, all these hippies were very poor, they had no money. So they would just be coming there. So many were coming, majority were coming only for the prasad. And of course, with the growing association of Jayanand, and you know, he would just so warmly welcome them. And he would do everything. See, he was also the biggest fund collector for them. He would go out, he would get the bhoga, and his personality was such that he would get people to donate to him. Large numbers of people, you know, in the wholesale markets and others would just donate to him or give him at great discount just because they loved him. Their deep respect and love for him. And the amazing thing is, you know, he, one of his most incredible, unprecedented quality, which is quite unusual, was that everybody, means even the Karbis or even the non-devotees, even the man on the street, loved him. It was absolutely astonishing how much love they had. And there are so many devotees who have spoken about that. That, for instance, he would, you know, in San Francisco, there is an area called the Fisherman's Wharf, which, you know, where you have a lot of these tough, you know, rough people. They're very crude, almost violent, you know, very, it's not easy, not at all easy to associate. And he would go there regularly, and all of them, they loved him. They just warmed up to him. They and so many of them would just, because he never, he was not a judgmental person. He never looked at them saying that, you know, you are condemned, or you know, how can you? He just, you know, gave himself to them. So with the result that they would, these wholesalers would often, you know, give him, almost every day bhoga was coming from either free or at substantial discounts. One day he took up the at that time the president was Keshav Prabhu. They were going to, and this Keshav Prabhu recalled later, that they saw a person, and then that person went into a bar. A bar is a permit room, what we call permit rooms here. Now, probably most of you have not been in a permit room, but if you, this is one common feature in any permit room anywhere in the world, or any bar anywhere, that is typical. You know, there is, the whole mood is so boisterous because they are all high on the alcohol content, and there is lots of loud music, very smoky atmosphere. It's not a very pleasant, you can hardly talk also. And Keshav Prabhu goes in with Jayanand Prabhu inside. And Keshav Prabhu was shocked. As soon as they went in, you know, all around people are, you know, sitting and dancing. The minute they saw Jayanand Prabhu, they all stood up. You know, just imagine in a bar. You know, that was a respect. And they were all smiling, and then, you know, this was before Rath Yatra. So they actually, you know, started, whatever they had, they, you know, gave him, and before he went, you know, they, so this was any person, anywhere, they, you know, and then even afterwards, many devotees, a few devotees, when they go down the street in dhoti and kurta and shave head, sometimes even drunks, people who were completely down and out, they would come to him, and they would, any devotee, and they would stagger up to him and say that, do you know Jayanand? He's my best friend. So this was the kind of, anyone would come. And when Maharaj was speaking about it, perhaps, what, 7-8 years ago, he gave a lecture on Jayanand Prabhu. He mentioned that even today, that was so probably, that even the elderly devotees who were there, even today it is not uncommon when somebody walks down the street as a devotee, they immediately they recognize. You know, somebody might come and say that, did you know Jayanand? I knew him. He was my best friend. So this was the kind of respect he could generate. And not that he was preaching, giving classes of Bhagavad Gita and all that, because they were not even in a mood to understand. They had no conception of philosophy. They have never heard the word Krishna. They couldn't even, it was beyond them. Most of them were, many of them would not be, you know, may not have even studied in schools and colleges, but those who did also obviously didn't have this in their curriculum. So they were completely ignorant of it. Even the city officials, they had such respect for him that getting the permits and everything was very easy. He would, because they knew him. And one storekeeper, there was a typical statement which was made by one storekeeper, which he made to a devotee, which is, you can say, was made by hundreds of outsiders to hundreds of devotees. This storekeeper told this devotee that, I don't know your philosophy. I have no understanding of what you do. But I know that Jayanand is the purest, nicest, most decent person I know in my whole life. So if he's a Hare Krishna devotee, if he's a Hare Krishna, then the Hare Krishnas must be doing something good. This was statement was heard hundreds of times everywhere because they didn't know what this Krishna consciousness is or nothing. But just knew this man and what he was, his purity, his desire to serve, his transparency, he never cheated anyone, and he never discriminated. This is a great quality of a saintly person that we see in the Acharyas and Prabhupada. You know, Prabhupada was the same. He went to Lower East Side. He also met Prime Minister Indira Gandhi, the same person, but he had the same desire to help the other person. So he never discriminated, he saw. So this person, Jayanand, also had the same quality that he never discriminated. So people sense that. And when the people sense that, and especially when they're starved of love, they would come to him. He was the greatest problem solver. But amazingly, nobody, because a lot of people would come to him with problems. I mean, a lot of people had problems anyway. So when they would come, in the beginning they may come to him to kind of get help. But actually, hardly anybody spoke to him about the problems, because just by working with him, he would give them some work and they're just cheerfully chatting through the day. By the time the evening would go, you know, the problem was solved, or they thought the problem was not worth discussing. So in that sense, he completely changed the perspective of people, because ultimately it's in the state of mind. You know, we consider this, it's such a heavy burden because we're concentrating only on one aspect of it and looking at it because it's such an obstacle or a hindrance to me and this. And then eventually we see it in the larger perspective. It happens to us when we come into the temple. When we're walking in, we are coming with such a baggage. And then if you've heard a class or we've gone through a festival, and we are so light-hearted, same person, just 2 hours to 3 hours later. So Jayana had that quality which he completely transformed the person's mood just by being with him. And he had that knack of engaging anyone. One devotee recounted that at 11:30 in the night, the Sankirtan van had broken down, and next day they needed the van. So he was also the car mechanic. He did everything, because he was a mechanical engineer anyway, so probably was very good at it. So this devotee comes out of the temple, and he found him under the van. And so half his body was under the van, only he could just see the bottom half and legs out, and he was doing something under the car. And busy talk at 11:30 in the night, and busy talking to two strangers, hippies who were just kind of going through, and he had engaged them, talked to them, and got them to help him fix the car. And he was preaching to them, talking to them about the aspects of Krishna consciousness. That this was a thing which many, many people recounted, that he had that ability to just get them off the streets and just help them. Once they had to lift heavy refrigerators, a few of them, and it was taking from one place to another, and they needed help. There were only a few of them. So he said he just went down the street and there were two hippies walking by, and he talked to them, and what he said, you know, how he said, but they just came along, and for free, they just worked the whole day. They spent several hours just helping, lugging the refrigerator. So he saw it as engaging them in service. He never saw that as exploiting, that let me reduce my burden. One thing about Jayanand was that he was the hardest worker. He would work 10 times harder than others. So even though he would have so many devotees, but he did the maximum. And everyone could see that. And he would also do those things which others could not or would not do. So he was always waiting to try to plug those gaps. Once, just before the Rath Yatra time, in fact, he is known as the king of Rath Yatra in ISKCON, because he was the one who would build these carts. And in those days, the carts had to be broken up after they didn't even have place to store for another year. And it's not like you can put it on the road anywhere. I mean, in the US, it would just not be allowed. So they had to dismantle and break it. So they would have to next year start all over again. So it was a major effort putting these carts together. And when Jayanand would start this weeks before, many people would come. You know, he had a team helping him. Now this team consisted of devotees. It was a mixed team. The devotees who were nice regular devotees were coming to the temple. Then there were people who were devotees at one time, maybe, and then they had left because they didn't like, they didn't get along with somebody or the other, or they had some quarrel with someone and they left. But they wanted to associate with Jayanand. So they would come to help him. Then there were devotees who were, then there were people who were total strangers of the street. So all these people, many of them didn't know each other, but they were all there to help him. And they would work through till late night, and he would, at that time, because he would not leave it unprotected, so he would be sleeping on the wooden planks in the Rath Yatra, and many of the men also would be sleeping there. So one devotee recounted that one day at 12:30 in the night, they finished, and they went inside, and it was quite common that many devotees would come from many centers, because the San Francisco Rath Yatra was the first one. So it was a new concept. It was not that many, many cities had it by then. So this is in the late 60s. So devotees from other centers would all come there, and also because Prabhupada would be there. So naturally they would like to come. So from far off places. So imagine a small temple was bursting, and it seems there was absolutely no place to, not even an inch to even step, everyone sleeping everywhere in the night. So at 12:30 when they finished work, so this devotee and Jayanand, they were among the last ones. So when they went in, they just stepped over sleeping bodies and went in, and somehow Jayanand found a small place in the closet, and they were physically, they used to be so tired that the minute the bodies hit the ground, it was not possible to raise them. It was, they were practically, you know, they just be asleep with physical exhaustion. So this devotee, the other devotee, he crashed down, and Jayanand then said, "You know, I'm just coming. I'll be back in a minute." So he said, "No, you know, where are you going?" "No, no, I'm coming back." So he, this devotee was insistent, and he said, "No, no, you tell me, where are you going now?" Then he kept on saying. Then he said, "No, no, I'm coming." Finally said that, you know, I have to finish a few rounds. So this devotee was shocked. He said, "It is like almost 1 o'clock in the morning. You have worked 18 hours. Okay, tomorrow you can make it up." He said, "No, I'm not tired. I have no problem." So such was his consciousness. You know, sometimes we have devotees who have tremendous attitude and desire to serve. But then in such a situation, to be able to, when you are physically exhausted, to have the purity to understand you know, the significance that at the base of it all, how important the holy name is very, very rare to find. And for him, the two things which are, he had such deep faith in two things. One was the holy name and the prasad. And this is what, that lessons which he imbibed from Prabhupada initially. Prabhupada would always lead the kirtan, he would take them to the park, or he would talk about, he was very simple messages. So he would stress about the kirtan, and secondly he would serve prasad, and he would give them lots of prasad. And the way he gave it. So this was one which he completely 100% totally absorbed in him. And he tried to use that to help others. One devotee asked him, he was a new devotee, so he asked him a question that, how does one make spiritual advancement? And Jayanand Prabhu, from the complete sincerity, his reply was, "I don't know, you know, I'm just too busy serving Prabhupada, I've not thought about it." And Prabhupada loved him so much, you know. This, many of his disciples, when they speak, Prabhupada's disciples, when they speak about Jayanand Prabhu, they would say, even in that book, Radha Damodar Vilas, they said that so many devotees would say that Prabhupada really loved him. So whenever Prabhupada came there, he would always ask, "Where's Jayanand? Where's Jayanand?" And Jayanand was, you know, busy doing something or the other. And when devotees would go and tell him that Prabhupada is looking for you, you know, he would feel really embarrassed. He's saying, I'm so dirty. How can I go to Prabhupada? You know, I'm so fallen. You know, he had that expertise of making everyone feel. I wouldn't say expertise, but it was not manipulated. It was just genuine. But he had that magical quality wherein, with all this that he was there, but he made everyone feel as if they're superior to him. It is quite amazing. He has such an ability to, or a presence of being so humble, because he actually genuinely felt that he was, and he was very happy in that position. So everyone else, you know, he would take them off the street, train them, put them in various positions. They became GBCs and sannyasis and gurus and presidents and all that later on. And they all speak about him. And he was very happy. He didn't have any position. He just wanted to do it. So, but of course, he would eventually do what Prabhupada wanted him to. But Prabhupada would be constantly asking, where is Jayanath? Then in 1976, a year before Prabhupada left the planet, Prabhupada's dream was being fulfilled. Prabhupada had one dream that he started this movement in New York, and he started this in the Lower East Side, you know, where there is absolutely no presence. It's really like a ghetto. But then over the next 9 years, it had really flourished to such an extent, so many temples were built, and so many thousands of devotees and lakhs of people who were interested and coming. It was really the news of the world practically. But his one dream was that the most prestigious street of the world, which is the Fifth Avenue of New York, he wanted the Rath Yatra to go down that Fifth Avenue. Now Fifth Avenue is in Manhattan, which is the most wealthiest district of New York. And New York, perhaps the wealthiest city of the world. So to have Fifth Avenue has all the key, you know, jewelry shops and the headquarters of corporations and fancy hotels. And I mean, it is really the poshest place. So to have it going down Fifth Avenue would really be such a prestigious event, because it would mean that if the permission is given, then it would mean that the city is acknowledging that this is one of the most important events for which the whole street has to be closed for the entire day. So it would be a major acknowledgement. Somehow, after so many years, in 1976, the devotees in New York worked, and it was miraculous, and they got the permission. So they invited Prabhupada, and of course, they invited Jayanand to build the carts, because he was the king of Rath Yatras. And he had to build 3 carts for Jagannathji, Baldevji and Subhadraji. And many, many devotees, hundreds of devotees flocked there, because it was the most exciting event in the ISKCON world also. And they also wanted to associate with Jayanand, you know, they were used to when coming help him. So it was a tremendous occasion for all. And of course, Prabhupada was going to come, and they just wanted to see Prabhupada sit on the devotees just wanted to see him, you know, ride on the chariot down Fifth Avenue. The same person who had come there with no money into New York, and now he's treated like a king, going down in the cart which is going down Fifth Avenue, would be, you know, for Prabhupada's followers, would be a greater sight. And 2 major events happened before the Rath Yatra. One of them, which happened about a week before, I'll come to it in a couple of minutes. But the other one was just the night before. The night before the Rath Yatra was to be there, and things were not completed. The carts were not completed, and at 11:30 in the night, it became very windy, and there was a sudden massive gush of wind coming over the Hudson River, and the dome flew off. Of Balram's cart, and the cart was badly damaged, and the other 2 carts were not damaged, but they were even less ready. Now next morning 6:30 they had to keep the cart ready, because the city officials would then cancel the permission if the cart would not reach a certain place by certain time. So they had to get it ready by 6:30, and it was Jayanand who, with the help of all the devotees there, somehow, amazingly, and with Krishna's grace, they worked whole night, nobody slept for even a minute, and got everything ready. At 6:30 everything was fine. And when Prabhupada came for the Rath Yatra a couple of days before, he came to the airport, he was greeted by hundreds of devotees, and Tamal Krishna Maharaj was with him. So Tamal Krishna Maharaj and Prabhupada were sitting at the back seat of the car. So Prabhupada asked Tamal Krishna Maharaj, who's driving? So Tamal Krishna Maharaj said, there is Jayanand Prabhu. So Prabhupada said, ah, Jayanand, I know him. He donated me $5,000, and he gave me $5,000 in 1967. So Prabhupada, 9 years later, also remembered immediately, you know, that this is the devotee who had given. And of course, he knew about his services. So we can take heart from this that we should know, we should have that that a firm conviction that in whatever activities we are doing, we need not seek recognition. But we should have that conviction that whether it is just following a regular sadhana or whether whatever service we are doing, that Krishna and Guru would always be knowing, and we don't have to demonstrate it, we don't have to somehow indirectly bring it to his notice or somehow pine and lament that you know, he's not knowing it. We should have the conviction that this will be pleasing to Krishna because it's pleasing to Guru. If it's pleasing to senior Vaishnavas, then Guru will be pleased. If Guru is pleased, then Krishna will be pleased. And Jayanand believed in that and lived his life accordingly. There was this devotee, Jankinath Prabhu. Jankinath Prabhu was a very, he had a very difficult childhood, and by the time he was in his teens, he had left. He was so frustrated that he left his home, and he became a drug addict. He was 24 hours practically stoned, as they say, you know, completely, entirely intoxicated with drugs, and he didn't know what was happening. Staying on the street, had no home, nothing, and he just happened to come across a Harinam Sankirtan on the road. So he was standing at the side, and as was typical, you know, when the Harinam Sankirtan goes, you know, you try to get all the bystanders into the main mainstream. So one devotee, heavy set and heavy voiced, his name was Guru Kripa Prabhu, you know, he came up to him and to this stoned out persons standing there, and he said loudly, you know, saying, "Chant, chant." So he didn't know what was happening, and he started chanting. He recounts later, he doesn't, you know, he said, "I probably chanted, I don't know." Then again he says, "Dance, dance." You know, so he was pushed in, and so he didn't know, he was doing whatever it was, he recounts vaguely that this is all he remembers. And then when the Harinam was over, then they piled up, and then whoever was interested, they would take them also to the temple. So Jankinath Prabhu was also taken to the temple. He didn't know where he's going, who's taking him. But he just was allowed himself, and he went. As soon as he went to the temple, then he was, because you know, devotees had done their job, and he kind of he was left there. And the thing is, he had not bathed in months, not cut his hair, he had not eaten in 4 days. He was absolutely, really like a bum on the street. Absolutely like a beggar, you know, worse than a beggar. So naturally, but you know, still devotees had the compassion to take him to the temple. But after that, they said, "Our job is done now." At that time, Jayanand Prabhu was the temple president, and he came out and he saw him, and with such love, you know, and such, he embraced him, and he talked to him, and he so kindly, and he said he brought prasad for him, sat to him, talked to him, preached to him. He spent such a long time with him. And this person is thinking that I didn't even know this person till a few minutes ago, and he has nothing to gain from me, and you know, he has such affection. He's more than my best friend, my father, my mother, and you know, he had such a difficult childhood, and he had nobody whom he could turn to in life. So obviously, he was so instantly attracted to this. Then he came the next day just to associate with Jayanand Prabhu, and the next day. And soon, you know, it was just a matter of time before he gave up all intoxication. He shaved his head and tilak, dhoti, joined the temple, became a devotee, and till this day. So how many devotees really got the impact of change of life just because of Jayanand Prabhu? The other event which I told you, which happened about a week or so before his, before the Rath Yatra, one night at about maybe 12:30, when almost everybody was asleep, and he was in some corridor of the New York temple, and that time they had a mansion there practically. They had this skyscraper in New York. And Prabhupada was very, very happy with it on Henley Street. And His Holiness Kesha Bharati Maharaj, he recounts that that time he was a brahmachari, and he saw Jayanand doubling up in pain. So he went up, and you know, so Jayanand had not seen him, so you know, he was practically bent with
looked like he was in pain. So Jain was surprised, but then he said, what happened? And he said, no, nothing happened. But of course, Keshav Bharati Maharaj was insistent that you have to tell me, you know. He was very disturbed to see him. And Jayan was saying no, but this argument went back and forth for some time, and finally they kind of came to a compromise. And Jayan said that, okay, you know, but don't tell anybody at least till the Rath Yatra is over. And Keshav Bharati Maharaj agreed, but he said, after Rath Yatra, you must go for a checkup. So, you know, he had a big tumor, and I think it was under his armpit, I'm not sure, but it was in great pain. But then after the Rath Yatra was over, and then it was detected that he had cancer. He didn't have much time to live. So this was probably September of 1976. And then over the next few months, he was very blissful. He was very ecstatic, you know, doing his sadhana, you know, whatever he could. But because devotees were insistent, he also went to hospitals and treatments, tried other things, just to please the devotees, really. And when devotees would visit him in the hospital, in fact, they would come there feeling sympathy for him, but inevitably they would leave thinking that he's having sympathy for them, and thinking that they are in a disease condition, because he was so ecstatic and he was so happy that they left feeling that we are actually in a disease condition, and we are okay, but our consciousness, and we are so disturbed or this and that, and he's completely peaceful. So like that, then of course things deteriorated, and then he was in the last days also, he was in the temple, he was attending Mangal Arati. And then I believe it was May 1st, but this day, 1977, he passed away from this world. And when Prabhupada heard the news, and Prabhupada was also in he had already started his pastime for departing from this world, he had stopped eating, and practically no drinking also, for so many months before. So when Prabhupada heard the news, he really manifested the love, the nature of the love that a Guru Maharaj, Guru has for his disciple. It's astonishing how, it's such a wonderful thing to hear and see, that he immediately ordered. First thing he did is, he actually, Prabhupada wrote a letter to him. After Jayanand's departure, Jayanand Prabhu's departure, Prabhupada writes a letter to him in first person. Okay, my dear Jayanand, please accept my blessings. A beautiful letter in which he makes few points. He said that you have perfected your life. Prabhupada saying this so categorically, it is like for all times to come. It was also meant for us to understand that how Prabhupada recognized this person's impact in life, and how Krishna would be seeing this person. Also, he said that you have gone back to Golok, Vrindavan, and I'm very grateful to him. I'm feeling separation from you, but you have gone back to Golok Vrindavan. So that was one thing. Then Prabhupada also ordered that from now on, for all times to come, to celebrate this great Vaishnava's departure, disappearance, on the same lines as, on the same way as we celebrate other disappearance days of Acharyas. And third, he said that on every Rath Yatra cart, his photo should be there. So anytime there's a Rath Yatra, Jayanand Prabhu's photo is there. And recently I heard one lecture, and Govind Prabhu was making the point about Jatayu, and I was just thinking the similarities in one sense between the two, between Jayanand Prabhu and Jatayu, because both were very loyal servants. See, Jatayu was also in one sense, he was not even a human. He was not initiated. He was in the worst form of a bird, a vulture. And he had, he was so old, 60,000 years old at that time. And yet, eventually he left, he went to the spiritual world. So, the service that is recognized by the Lord, and in his case, in Jatayu's case, he had a benediction which he had got from Dashrath Maharaj, because Dashrath Maharaj, he had helped him successfully in the battle against Shani, when there was a 12-year drought. And the benediction that Dashrath Maharaj had given him was that he would have that parental affection towards Dashrath Maharaj's son, Lord Ram. Now the amazing thing is that Dashrath Maharaj forgot, and Jatayu also forgot. But Lord Ram didn't forget. So the point is that eventually Lord Ram, just like he fulfilled Shabari's desire after so many years, when she was a small child to an old age, and he finally came. Same way in Jatayu's case also, the whole situation is created in such a way that he came there just practically moments before he was departing, and he could personally cradle his body in his arms. So same way in Jayanand Prabhu's example also, we see that his service to Prabhupada was so immense and so perfect that Prabhupada wanted everyone to, you know, every year at least dwell upon this devotee and see. If we cannot even compare ourselves with him, but we can understand the glaring omissions that are there in our service, in our thinking, or in our deviousness in our minds, and how we can actually come closer to this perfection that was so close, and that was there in our yoga, in our time. And he came in as a disciple of Prabhupada, so which is really much easy to understand in the social milieu that is USA, where we are familiar with in the world of materialism, and he was right up there. And Maharaj actually, in conclusion, I would say that Maharaj said one very nice point about Jayanand Prabhu's departure. He said that just like Haridas Thakur did not want to see Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's departure, same way he created a situation that Krishna created a situation where Jayanand Prabhu could depart before Prabhupada's disappearance. So he didn't have to go through that. So we'll end here. There is an announcement for. So, if there are any questions anybody has or any comments? Granthraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. Shri Prabhupada ki jai. His Grace Jayanand Prabhu ki jai.